This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you catch up on some of the biggest news from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, September 18th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. How would you like an extra $500 a month to use however you see fit? No strings attached. Beginning later this year, 200 Pittsburghers will be getting just that for a period of 2 years. The idea of a universal or guaranteed basic income isn't new. In fact, it dates back more than 500 years to Sir Thomas More's socio-political satire novel Utopia. More recently, former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang called it a freedom dividend. Here he is on NPR last year talking about his proposal to give every American $1,000 a month.
There's virtually no American who's like, oh, I'm going to quit my job. We got $1,000 a month. Like that's not really, you know, not ready to pack it in $1,000 a month. So it's enough to be a game changer, but it's not meant to be a full work replacement, and it's certainly not meant to solve every problem.
Here to tell us more about this idea and Pittsburgh's pilot program is WESA's government and accountability reporter, Anlie Herring. Anlie, welcome to Explainer.
Thank you.
What's the idea behind a universal basic income?
The idea is that the government, or in the case of the city of Pittsburgh, philanthropic funders will provide a sufficient level of income to residents of the city. And there are different versions of how you can go about this, but like I said, in Pittsburgh, philanthropic groups are expected to fund the program here. So what that looks like in Pittsburgh, there will be 200 very low-income families who will be selected to participate in a pilot program that will run for 2 years, and it will start by the end of this year. And the families will receive monthly payments of $500. The people who will be chosen to participate will come from households that make 50% of the area median income. So for a household of four in Pittsburgh in 2020, that is about $40,000, a little bit over that. And they'll be given these payments really with no strings attached, aside from the fact that they have low enough incomes to qualify. And the city is going to evaluate whether these payments actually do improve their well-being. And they're also going to really be focusing on households led by Black women.
This doesn't actually sound universal if they're only targeting very low-income people. Is the idea that eventually, if this is shown to be successful, everyone would get this money?
I don't get the sense that that's where Mayor Peduto sees this headed. He really views this as a program that's meant to target poverty and try to mitigate poverty in this city. And I probably should have said earlier that universal basic income is the idea that every citizen is given a sufficient income on a regular basis from the government or charities. But what we're talking about here is probably more appropriately called guaranteed income, and that's the term that the city is using. And the mayor said that he really views this as a direct form of support that really goes to the heart of what poverty is in his mind, and that is just that people do not have enough money to pay for the basic necessities.
So this is a little bit different than what Andrew Yang was talking about with his freedom dividend, where just everyone would get $1,000 a month. This is very targeted. It almost sounds similar to like existing programs that we have, such as welfare.
Yeah, it is quite different from what Yang had proposed. He would have given payments of $1,000 every month to every American. And here, like you said, it is going to be a more targeted approach. And this pilot program is quite small scale to start out. And I think that is a good comparison to make. You could view this as a social welfare program. And a common criticism is that it's just a form of socialism and that we should be wary of moving in this direction. But when Mayor Peduto spoke with a group of mayors on Wednesday, they're also going to be piloting similar programs. The mayor of Philadelphia, Jim Kenney, noted that programs like Social Security have gotten mainstream support. They're just kind of a regular part of our culture, and he thinks that guaranteed minimum income could be part of the fabric of our social safety net, too. So it's not really different from other programs if you think about it, but critics will say that you have to work to earn your Social Security, and there is a concern that people who get a guaranteed income on a monthly basis, even though it's not like you could feed a family of four on that, that people will have a disincentive to working and that they'll quit their jobs, and people worry about what that could lead to. So there is that distinction, but the proponents of this concept would say it's just a way to strengthen our social safety net.
Is anyone actually doing this full stop, like not part of a pilot program, whether like a city or a country?
In the U.S., there's not a full-fledged program, although Stockton, California has run its own pilot where they're also giving $500 monthly payments for about a year and a half. The mayor there, Michael Tubbs, actually launched this nationwide initiative with more than two dozen cities that are also testing out the idea. And that's what Pittsburgh is part of. They're called the Mayors for Guaranteed Income. But other than that, we're not seeing anything really beyond the pilot programs. In other countries, there have been some trials where they're trying out this idea. Finland used it to provide support to unemployed people, and they were hoping that that would actually lead people to try to find jobs, because there is often this trade-off for the lowest income citizens where they are receiving some benefits from the government and they don't want to get a job because that could lead them not to qualify for some of the government benefits that they'd been getting because it will raise their overall household income. But other than some trials in some other countries, this really is not an idea that's taken off anywhere in recent history.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this pilot plays out in Pittsburgh. Anli, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
Millions of people in the U.S. don't have enough food to eat, and the pandemic has only made things worse. Food pantries are seeing increased demand, closed schools are figuring out new ways to get food to families, and for many receiving food assistance, the $150 to $200 a month just isn't cutting it. Sunday on All Things Considered, what it means to be food insecure and what can be done about it.
Black lives, they matter where?
Black lives, they matter where?
Black lives.
Every weekend for nearly 4 months, activists with the group Black, Young, and Educated led a series of protests dubbed Civil Saturdays. Hundreds, if not thousands, of Pittsburghers have participated in the demonstrations, which aim to call attention to the state's police use of force statute. Here's organizer Nick Anglin.
We need to end police brutality. We need to increase police accountability. And that is exactly why we need to amend PA Section 508.
WESA's Katie Blackley was at the final Civil Saturdays event last weekend and joins us now. Katie, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
What did the organizers say about why they're ending Civil Saturdays?
They told me they are tired. They've been doing this for 4 months, 16 weeks. Every Saturday, and sometimes these protests can last hours. These are young people who are starting to go back to school. They said, you know, this isn't the end of the movement, but we cannot be leading it every Saturday anymore. And I think everybody kind of understood that.
You attended quite a few of these events. Can you talk about what the atmosphere was like?
This is led by a group called Black, Young, and Educated, and that young part really stuck out to me. A lot of times you do see young faces in protests and demonstrations like this, but I think these were overwhelmingly populated by young people, the Gen Z as they call them, and these are energetic people. They're very passionate about their mission and the movement, and there was a lot of dancing at these. I mean, there were people, they had a whole soundtrack essentially to these things. They bring instruments and drums and... But they also bring out some guest speakers. So the main thing, they do have a main mission for these Civil Saturdays, but they often invite people who represent other protest movements in the city. So they talk about Danielle Brown and how her hunger strike is ongoing.
That's the mom of the Duquesne University student who died on campus 2 years ago.
Correct. Yes, they talk about Danielle Brown. They talk about diversity within the police force, and they speak about, you know, some other families who have experienced deaths of family members at the hands of police, Antoine Rose, Ramir Talley. So they do have a main mission, and they always stick to it. They introduce it each time they start a protest, but ultimately there's a lot going on there.
Now, I know some of the protests in Pittsburgh have ended in confrontations with police. Was this something we often saw at Civil Saturdays?
The Civil Saturdays leaders, the Black, Young, and Educated people, were not typically involved in these kinds of things. There were some incidents, like there was a bike marshal who got kind of taken into a van by police, and that happened at a Civil Saturdays. There was an incident where some people confronted people eating at a restaurant and got some charges against them, but those were not the Black, Young, and Educated folks. So I would say it's interesting that these have not really gotten the same response. There was an incident as well where they kind of talked about not wanting to coordinate with the police, but I never saw any confrontations that severe.
And it's worth noting, you know, unlike some other organizers in Pittsburgh, the folks from Black, Young, and Educated have not been arrested or facing any charges related to their protest activities, right?
Not at all. And there were even incidents where, you know, you'd see somebody kind of yelling at police or maybe expressing anger toward cops, or there was someone, you know, kind of heckling the group. And the organizers of Civil Saturdays would say, do not respond to those people. Do not engage. This is not why we're here. We're here to be peaceful.
You said that the organizers of Civil Saturdays said the movement is not over. We have other things we need to do right now. So what comes of this effort to amend Section 508 of the state code, which currently basically says that police are justified in using force if they believe it's necessary to avoid bodily harm to themselves or someone else? Is an effort to amend this gaining any traction in the state legislature?
When I spoke with the Black, Young, and Educated organizers the first few weeks, they would tell me a lot about Section 508, and I personally was not very familiar with it. And they would do this thing at the beginning where they'd ask everybody who had heard of it to raise their hand. And the first few times, just a sparse amount of people raised their hand. The last one, all the hands shot up, and people could almost, you know, recite it word for word. I mean, it's very technical language, but they knew exactly what was in it and kind of what they wanted to be changed about it. So yes, there are some bills in the legislature that exist. They're in committee, and there's not been a lot of movement so far, but they are there. I spoke with Treasure Palmer of Black, Young, and Educated, who told me the local representatives had reached out to them and said, we are hearing you.
A lot of people have reached out to us. A lot of our representatives have spoke to us and let us know that they've never gotten this many emails about Section 508 in general. So I feel like we've made an impact, and I think we've really gotten our message out there.
So we'll see what comes of it in the fall, if there is any movement, and I'm sure the Black, Young, and Educated and the Civil Saturdays demonstrators will be paying close attention.
And it's worth noting that, you know, we're sort of closing in on the end of the year here. The state legislative session will come to an end. So if these bills don't get any movement, they will have to be reintroduced next session. Well, Katie, thank you so much for all your reporting. Thank you for spending so many of your Saturdays out documenting this protest movement in Pittsburgh.
I think it's a really important thing to document. So thanks, Liz.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
Creating a fall routine that gets you back in the swing of things, it's pretty hard right now. Whether it's working out every day or just not hitting the snooze button. Whatever your morning is like, listen to Morning Edition from NPR News on your smart speaker, your phone, or even a radio. Then, no matter what else does or doesn't happen, you'll be informed and ready to tackle the day ahead. Listen every weekday.
This week, a federal judge ruled that Governor Tom Wolf's shutdown orders and limits on in-person gatherings in response to the coronavirus pandemic were unconstitutional. Back in March, Wolf ordered all non-life-sustaining businesses to close and residents to stay home as much as possible. Butler County government, the main plaintiff in the case, said those restrictions violated the First and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, and Judge William Stickman IV agreed. Here to explain more about the ruling and what it might mean for Pennsylvanians is WITF Capitol reporter Sam Dunklaw. Sam, welcome back to Explainer.
Thanks for having me, Liz. I appreciate you having me on.
What did Stickman say in his ruling?
So this guy Stickman, who we can get into a little bit later, is one of these judges who kind of follows the new conservatism movement in his line of judicial thinking. And in his opinion, which was 66 pages long, he talked about this need for individual rights to be more important and like at the forefront of any governmental decision. Right off the bat in the first page, he had called the emergency efforts of state leaders. And of course, we're talking about Governor Tom Wolf and Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine, for what they've done so far in the pandemic. You know, they've shuttered non-essential businesses. They've limited the capacity at restaurants. They've required people to wear masks and socially distance. He gave them credit where credit is due in saying that those efforts have been laudable, but that even the most laudable efforts can infringe on individual rights is basically what he said. So right off the bat in the first page, actually, this is a little bit closer down to the second page. It said, even in an emergency, a vigilant public may lay its guard down over its constitutional liberties to find that liberties once relinquished are hard to recoup, and that restrictions, while expedient in the face of an emergency situation, may persist long after the immediate danger is passed. And Liz, we've heard this from other people in Pennsylvania. We've heard this from State House Republicans, something to the effect of this, that who have railed for months against the governor and the health secretary for what they feel are overbearing restrictions. They've campaigned to reopen the state as much as possible. And it seems as though Stickman, in writing this ruling, was agreeing with a lot of their logic, that the individual rights of people to make their own decisions should be more important, even in the face of a public health emergency, with all these new and novel things that nobody's ever had to combat before. And so that's sort of where we're at. And to the extent that it's a win, we're not sure.
Now, the stay-at-home order has been lifted, and most businesses have been allowed to reopen with certain restrictions. Like, what impact does this ruling really have?
And that's what I was trying to figure out in my story this week. I talked to Duquesne University School of Law professor Bruce Leidowitz, who enlightened me on a lot of different avenues about this ruling. And what he had said was a lot of what Stickman had ruled on is no longer in effect. He saw it as sort of a symbolic ruling, that symbolically what the actions that the governor and the health secretary took early on in the pandemic were unconstitutional, and not that they are currently, because, as you've said, there is no stay-at-home order anymore. Businesses across the spectrum, I'm not going to say all businesses, but businesses in a lot of sectors have been able to reopen, granted at limited capacity, and people are able to kind of move about more freely than they were before. Leidowitz had even gone to the extent of saying that, you know, there are gatherings that are happening right now, political gatherings, religious gatherings, and those have not necessarily been limited by the current orders that are in place. All of which is to say there isn't really a practical impact of this. This is really more a conservative justice saying these things are unconstitutional on their face, and if you try them again, this is the ruling that will be in place, at least for now.
Well, that brings me to my next question. Like, let's say in the winter, you know, we see sort of an extreme surge of COVID-19 cases, or God forbid, another pandemic hits us. Could this tie Wolf's or a future governor's hands if they were to decide to put certain restrictions back in place?
It could. What's going to be the determining factor on that is just how far this case is going to go. As was reported this last week, Wolf himself has said, and the governor's office asserted even before he said, that they're going to appeal it. Leidowitz had told me that it's going to go to the Third Circuit of Appeals, and the justices will comb over it with a fine-tooth comb, and they'll determine whether or not those orders were in fact unconstitutional, because it's a question that's happening sort of in states across the country. In terms of whether or not it will hold the Wolf administration back from potentially implementing another, let's say, stay-at-home order if things get bad enough, it could face that they could face an immediate barrier with that, because there is this ruling that says, you know, that particular action is unconstitutional and here's the reasons why. But Leidowitz pointed out that the Wolf administration could potentially do some, as I was describing it in my interview with him, some judicial jujitsu. They could do some legal jujitsu and essentially put in place a new set of orders and define them differently in the legal language that they present, which would, in effect, render the court ruling moot. They could present these new restrictions, these new orders on the basis of public health by arguing, well, actually, we're doing it a little bit differently than was presented in the court case, and so therefore we can do it and it's not unconstitutional. Whether or not the Wolf administration will go that route, it's unclear at the moment, but that might be one particular legal avenue that would essentially, once again, render the court ruling more symbolic than practical.
Who is this judge? Who is William Stickman?
So I had to do a little digging on this. Stickman was born in Pittsburgh. And he's lived there for much of his life. He has been a scholar of classics and history and the law for a long time. He clerked for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for a time, and he's gone into private practice with a couple of lawyers before being appointed by President Trump last May. And at his Senate confirmation hearing, the Republican majority in the Senate had actually invoked cloture, which is a technical term that sort of closes the debate off and forced a vote on Stickman and a few other people. And as you could probably guess, the Senate had largely appointed him on partisan along a partisan line. Most of the Republicans voted yes, most of the Democrats voted no, and there were, if, when you go through the voting record, a few that Democrats that did break the line and said, okay, Stickman, we can appoint him to this federal position in Pittsburgh. And there were a few independents that said, nah, well, maybe not. And that's where he's been. He hasn't been in that position for very long. And as far as we know, this has been really the first big ruling that has captured, you know, statewide and national attention in terms of how does a judge rule on COVID-19 orders.
Sam, thanks so much for your reporting on this issue.
Thanks for having me, Liz. Appreciate it.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.